mitzvah is, which is Lo tamod al dam reyacho, do not stand by the blood of your fellow man. And we explained last time that don't stand by his blood literally means that when he's dying, don't look away. Don't say, it doesn't concern me. When he's drowning, you can't just say, I'm all right, so why should I jump into the cold water? You have the obligation to save him. Included in the mitzvah is Sheim noda lo eidut. What about if you have information that will help your fellow man? She'eino rashai lishtok. You don't have the right to keep quiet. So when someone tells you something, even if he told it to you in strict confidence, but you know that through that information you can save someone's life, for sure you're obligated to tell him. And if not, you're responsible for his death. But by extension, the rabbis learn out from it that any information that you have that may help someone in any part or any aspect of his life, you have the obligation to tell him. Now, included in this mitzvah is lerodef achar chavero, the mitzvah of the pursuer. That if you, when you see one person pursuing another person, and the victim, according to your judgment, who is an innocent victim, his life is in danger, chayav latzilo benafsho, you have to do everything in your power to save his life, if you can, by stopping the pursuer. If you can't, by killing the pursuer. Shorech mitzvah zu yadua, the roots, the idea behind the mitzvah is obvious. He says, Kmo she'echad yatzilet chavero, chavero yatziloto. Because in order to establish a decent society, we have to feel responsibility for our fellow men. Now, we mentioned that there is a very, very important argument concerning the following problem. What about if in order to save someone's life, I have to put my life in danger? Here, up to now we have been talking about a situation when all I have to do is just be uncomfortable, jump into the cold water in order to save someone's life. That is obvious. Of course, you have to save him. But what about if you have to risk your own life in order to save someone else's life? That is an argument whether you have the right to do it, let alone the obligation. It seems that this is unanimous. You don't have the obligation to do it. But there is an argument whether you have the right to do it. There are some authorities which believe that you don't even have the right. The same way that you are not allowed to commit suicide, you don't have the right over your own life. You have no right to risk your life, even if it means perhaps saving somebody else's life. Or even if it means for sure saving somebody else's life, but your life is at risk. That is already a complicated question, and there are arguments among the authorities. Yeah.
Saving their life, you're saving them from the harem. In other words, if they kill someone else, then they will be going to Gehenna. So, in effect, by stopping them
from killing someone, you're also
saving them from becoming murderers. From murderers, and therefore going to
Gehenna. You are right, but sometimes that won't apply. What about if you see someone who already killed 10 people and now he's going to kill the 11th? That for his Gehenna, it won't make such a big difference, right? He's doomed anyway, and you still are obligated to kill him. In other words, you are right that that we also say that in a way you're helping the murderer, the potential murderer. You are stopping him from committing a crime. But the point is, even if he is already a murderer from previous cases, you are still obligated to stop it. Yeah.
If you would be saving or protecting a family member where you will be willing to risk your life, would you say you would have no right there also?
Again, according to some authorities, you don't have the right. You don't have the right. Of course, sometimes it becomes a very emotional issue. What would you say about, there was, I don't know if you read about the fact that the father had a portion of his liver transplanted to his child. Now, of course, it's an operation, and like every operation, it has its risks to the father. The child, it's not certain that the child is going to live, but it's possible that the child is going to live. So, can you tell a father, don't do it, because you are risking your life, right, in order to save your own child? It's very, very difficult to tell a father, but there are authorities who say, listen, I mean, this is what we have to do. You have more of an obligation to your own life, which right now is not at risk by having that transplant of a portion of the liver. You're actually risking his own life, his child's life, because in any case, I mean, it's not for sure that the child is going to live. But it's an emotional issue. Who can tell the father, don't do it? So there are questions about it, whether it's we have the obligation to force the father not to do it. You know, it's whether society has the obligation to force him, or he is given the choice. Let's go on to the next mitzvah. This is 238. It's a negative commandment. It's a very difficult commandment. Shelo lisno sinat halev. You are not allowed to hate your fellow man. There is an actual prohibition against hatred. Sheneemar, and he quotes the verse in the Torah, lo tisnai tachicha bilevavecha. Don't hate your brother in your heart. That's a question. There are many, many authorities which say that it includes anyone, listen to the words used, who shares your scale of values. But anyone who doesn't is not included in the statement, your brother. Now, according to this definition, it won't make a difference, Jew or Gentile. Now, it's even a Jew who doesn't share your values. For instance, I don't know, he becomes a savage. He has no values himself, so you don't share with him the same values, so therefore you wouldn't have that obligation. As a matter of fact, as we're going to see later on, sometimes it says it's permitted to hate such a person. But someone who you share with him your scale of values, you are not allowed to hate him. Yeah? Again, I mean, hatred wouldn't be permitted. Let me go on. I'll explain more in detail. and then he goes on to say, now, what does it mean when the Torah say, don't hate him in your heart? There is an implication here. It's not right to hate him in your heart. But what about if it's not just in your heart? What about if you express your hatred? Right? So he says the following, that although you will be transgressing other laws if you express your hatred, but this particular law only concerns hatred in your heart. Once it's expressed, you don't transgress this particular law. Let me explain what he means over here. There is another law, and he quotes it. We are going to be reading it in a little while. You are not allowed to show revenge. You're not allowed to take revenge for someone who did something wrong to you. Now, taking revenge doesn't mean necessarily when I asked you for money you didn't give me, so I won't give you any money. That's not the only specific case of what the Torah prohibits as an act of revenge. Anything can be an act of revenge. What about if you asked him for money, he didn't give it to you, so next time when you see him, you don't say hello to him? That's all. That is also an act of revenge. What about if you do say hello to him, but usually you would smile at him, and this time it was a hello without a smile? According to the Torah law, you have transgressed the law of taking revenge, because you are not allowed to act any differently, right? Again, nobody ever said that being Jewish is easy. I mean, it's a very, very difficult mitzvah to fulfill. But that's a fact. That's what the Torah demands from us, that we shouldn't be at all affected by what someone does to us. So it's probably one of the most difficult mitzvahs to fulfill, not to be affected at all, right, in your actions. So he says, if you show anger, right, then you are taking revenge. Do you follow the idea? When do you show anger usually? Somebody bumped into you, for instance. So by showing anger, what are you doing? It's a type of a taking of revenge. Do you follow the idea? It's a reaction to something that someone else did wrong to you. Right? So if you, if the same prohibition which says, don't, if somebody bumped into you, don't push him back, the same prohibition tells you, don't stop smiling at him, and the same prohibition tells you, don't scream at him, because they are all acts of revenge. What else is it? The reaction, somebody does something wrong to you, start screaming at him. It's getting back at him. It's a way of getting back at him. So that would be included, he says, in the prohibition against taking revenge. So he says expressed anger, that is already included in revenge. What the Torah is telling you now, don't hate him in your heart, it means unexpressed revenge. Do you hear what his point is? Which means when the Torah says, don't hate your fellow men in your heart, the Torah is not implying that if you express it, it's okay. The Torah is telling you that besides the prohibition against expressing anger, which is already included in taking revenge, there is another prohibition even if you don't take revenge. But if you allow the feeling to linger in your heart, you transgress the law. Yeah, somebody wanted to... Yeah. That is the idea. That's what the Torah prohibits, bearing a grudge.
This is under bearing a grudge.
That would be the definition, as a matter of fact, right? This is how you would put it, actually, bearing a grudge. Now, I just want to clarify, you know, as an aside, you know that when the Torah prohibits emotions or thoughts, like for instance, you know that there is it's something that we say twice a day, don't follow your eyes and your hearts, right? Or your hearts and your eyes, which means that you may have certain thoughts crossing your mind. Is that a prohibition, that when a thought crosses your mind, is that a prohibition? Are you transgressing anything? Say the commentators, you don't transgress anything by a thought crossing your mind. Because thoughts crossing your mind are usually, and I'll explain what the word usually means in this case, is beyond your control. Your control is in the fact that you allow the thought or the emotion to linger. That is where your control comes in. The crossing outside of yourself. I once mentioned that in many, many commentaries, it says that was the essential dialogue between Adam and the serpent. Because the word serpent in Hebrew is nachash. And nachash is very closely connected with machshava and lenachesh, which all imply thoughts that cross your mind, which means that the dialogue between the serpent and Eve is the expression of the dialogue between man and his thoughts. So the same way that the nachash is something external to him, man's thoughts are external to him. So when they cross your mind, it's not you thinking. It's the world of thought crossing your mind. Do you hear this idea? It's only when you decide to adopt that particular thought or let it linger or keep it or taste it or enjoy it for more than the split second that it takes for it to go through your mind, that is where your choice comes in and where you are responsible from. Okay? So when somebody bumps into you and the thought or the emotion crosses your heart or your mind that, oh, what a terrible thing. And the moment it crosses your mind, you remove it from your mind because you say, well, I'm not allowed to feel it that way or think that way. Then you have not transgressed at all. So just to clarify, whenever the Torah prohibits a thought or an emotion, we are not talking about the seed of the emotion, like the split second in which the emotion or the thought hits you. It's the second moment when you have a choice whether you're going to push it away from your mind or let it linger. This is where the Torah tells you don't do it. Okay? So the fact that a person momentarily gets angry, that is irrelevant according to the Torah law. Now, we believe that a person can raise himself to such a spiritual level that he can build a wall around his thoughts, and the nachash, that serpent, doesn't have an entry, can't even enter his thoughts. But that is already a much higher spiritual level when you become immune to the serpent. You understand what I mean by symbolically, metaphorically, by the serpent? Yeah. That momentary anger, in other words, the thought that comes into your mind, and as soon as it comes in, you remove it, that is completely out of your control. If you comment,
you make a face, right?
That's already within your control.
Yeah, right. So
right? It's that momentary, like when it hits you, and you immediately react against it, you have fulfilled the obligations of the Torah. Okay?
You
have not transgressed. In other words, if the thought hits you and you don't let it affect you at all, you haven't transgressed at all. I just wanted to clarify, because many people feel guilty if they have that momentary feeling. And that, according to the Torah, is 100% permitted at the lower level. Of course, our obligation is to rise to the level in which we are not going to be vulnerable to the thought, but that's a much higher level. Yeah.
But isn't there a growing process where your thoughts will change?
What do you mean?
Where you, after a certain, as you grow, the process of growing, you will have different thoughts that come into you.
Sure, sure. That means that eventually, the thought of anger won't be able even to penetrate your conscious mind. In other words, there won't even be a split second in which you will feel anger. Right? That is a much higher level. That's something that we have to strive for. But it does not mean that if you feel that momentary anger, you have transgressed the Torah law. Okay?
So what happens if a person keeps doing something that irritates you? You're not allowed to be angry. You're not allowed to say anything about it.
All right. So that is the next mitzvah, which is closely connected. Perhaps we should read it, since you mentioned it. The next mitzvah, which is 239, is Hocheyach Tochiyach Et Amitecha. You have the obligation to rebuke him, which means to express exactly what is irritating you. This is 239. Here they are both connected. As a matter of fact, in the verse, it's all one long sentence. Do not hate your fellow man in your heart. Rebuke him. Tell him what bothers you. By telling him what bothers you, you're not taking revenge. You understand why not? Because you're not reacting to something wrong that he did to you by doing something wrong to him. By rebuking him, you are just trying to rectify what he did wrong. That is exactly what the Torah wants you to do. The Torah wants that momentary feeling should translate itself in your rebuking him, which means telling him how to do things right.
What if it's your parents?
What?
What if it's your parents?
All right, that's it. All right, we'll talk about it. Okay, so is this clear, the interconnection between 238 and 239, right? One follows the other. Then we are just jumping back again to 238. And he goes on to say, Shoresh HaMitzvah, the idea behind the mitzvah, that you are not allowed to hate anyone, Yadua, that's obvious, Kisinat Halev, because that feeling of hatred in your heart, Goremet Ra'ot Gdolot Ben Bnei Adam, the greatest problems among human beings stem from the fact that people allow that negative feeling towards each other to linger. And it says, Liotamit cheref ishbe achiv veishbe re'eyu. Eventually, you know what it leads to? To the sword, he says. Anger is just the first step to the sword. So even though you say, well, but I'm not a violent person, so what's wrong with hating? Now, we believe that when you hate, you bring into the world that characteristic of hatred. Now, again, as an aside, do you know that there is something which is, again, it's very, very difficult to accept, because you can bring into a laboratory and prove it. But for us, faithful Torah Jews, for us, it's a matter of course. It's something basic. We believe that when a person does something wrong, let's say, for instance, you steal, right? So you say, for sure you are doing something wrong to yourself too. Of course, you are damaging the victim, you are taking something away from him, but you are doing something bad to you. You are becoming a thief. Okay? Now, what does it do to the rest of the world? You say, well, nothing. Nobody saw me stealing, right? Isn't that the first reaction? Nobody saw me stealing. Of course, if I steal in the open, then I'm not only damaging myself, I'm damaging everybody who saw me, because they are going to be influenced by the fact that I stole. Right? This is conventional wisdom will say. Torah wisdom will go one step further and say, even if no one saw me, the fact that I stole creates, let me put it into the words and then I'll explain it, waves of dishonesty that will be picked up by everyone around me. And now I'll explain what the statement means. The statement means that there are certain interactions among human beings that we don't see, we can't touch, but they exist. And the only way we can describe it as is as invisible waves. Now, this concept of invisible waves has been mentioned in our literature. I mean, it concerning many, many things. That's brought down in almost recent literature that the Gaon of Vilna. Did you ever hear of the Gaon of Vilna? One of the greatest minds in the last few hundred years. He had a few very close disciples. And one day he calls over one of his main disciples and he tells him, you know, I have had a problem on the Talmud, a Talmudic problem, for weeks and weeks. And this morning I came up with the answer and I want to share it with you. And he says to his disciple, the problem was such and such and such and such. And he presents him the problem. And the disciple immediately comes up with the answer. And the Gaon of Vilna tells him, that's exactly what I thought. And the disciple says to him, you know, Rabbi, you know, I don't understand. You say that for weeks and weeks the question has been bothering you. How can it be that I, lowly disciple of yours, I'm able to answer it immediately? So the Gaon of Vilna says, why? Don't you know that once someone has reached the answer, he creates the waves of the answer, which immediately can be picked up by anyone who is attuned, whose radar is open to that particular thought. So you can actually pick it up. And I've mentioned this in the past. I have read this, I'm sure you have too, that sometimes a certain solution in a problem in physics, in medicine, in other things, in mathematics, is a problem that has been bothering scientists for years and years and years. And within a matter of days, the answer comes up in China, United States, Russia. What happened? I mean, this is an incredible thing that it happens at the same time. So you find all kinds of theories why it happens. Because they say, well, the development of the thought takes a certain amount of time, and since it happened in China, so the same amount of time it happened in the United States or in Russia. We believe that that's not the reason. We believe that the reason is that the moment a certain thought is reached, it creates invisible waves that anyone who is attuned to it can actually pick them up without knowing that he's picking up somebody else's thoughts. The same thing goes with people's actions. The moment I transgress a law, when I become a thief, automatically everybody in the world or everybody close to me immediately will be a tiny amount less honest than he was before. He doesn't even know that. He doesn't know why all of a sudden it becomes a little bit easier for him to lie or to cheat. Right? But it's I who caused it by lying or cheating or stealing. Right? And of course, if each one of us will do it, we are just causing the same thought to multiply. And of course, that will cause the spiritual level of all the people to come down very, very strongly. So you see how the Jewish people see how the Torah Jew views the idea of mutual responsibility. That not only am I responsible for what I do to you directly, I'm responsible when I do something in the privacy of my own home. If it's wrong, it will create certain waves that will be picked up by everybody. Yeah.
Does the Torah believe this of non-Jews? What they do affects?
Oh, no question about it. Of course. of course, and vice versa, which obviously there are levels. You know, certain people create stronger waves than others, that we believe. But that everybody creates waves, that is something that we accept as a fact, yeah. No question about it, that the thief does tshuva, he rectifies his actions, right? That will create a hiring of everybody else's level, because the same thing works on the other way around. Every good deed that you do will have an impact on everybody else. It may be minute, right? But it adds up. Yeah?
In other words, it's like sort of like ripple effects in the water.
That's it.
The consequences reach outward, further and further, and never widening circles is what you're...
Right, that's the idea. That's the idea. And it's never lost. It's never lost. You can't say at a certain point it stops. It's always there. It always remains, yeah?
Sounds like existentialism.
Like? Why?
Existentialism, as in 10,000 years ago, someone did something which made it fact for today.
Yeah, we take this for granted, that no action is ever lost or erased. It will always have an effect somewhere.
Like a ripple in the water might make a tidal wave today.
Right, right. Exactly.
But
exactly.
The only way to counter that effect would be...
To rectify it, right? Or to
get back.
Right? You can balance it by a good deed, for instance. Okay? So, this is a very, very important principle when we talk about the mutual responsibility. Mutual responsibility. So, therefore, when I see someone doing something wrong, right? So, I have to give him to understand that he is responsible for me. He is responsible indirectly for the whole world. And if he answers back to you, well, listen, it's my own private life, right? I can do whatever I want. Well, of course he can do whatever he wants. I mean, no police will stop him from doing it, but he has to know his own responsibility. And if I know that he doesn't know, I have the obligation to tell him. That is the obligation of rebuking him, which means giving him to understand the Torah concept of mutual responsibility, how we are all so intertwined, yeah? The appropriate way to rebuke? How to rebuke? Let me just tell you something concerning rebuke. You know that there is a certain halakha which says that if a person rejects rebuke, right? He's in a different level. There is a certain status. A rejecter of rebuke. Right? We won't go into the details what is his status, but there is such a status as a rejecter of rebuke. So one of the great, great authorities, almost a contemporary of ours, he says nowadays that status doesn't exist. Why? Because we have lost our capacity for rebuke. You hear the statement? We have lost the skill for rebuke. We have lost it. Oh, so you know, I was always wondering, for a long, long time it bothered me. What does it mean we have lost it? First of all, who is we? Right? It doesn't mean this generation, this man who writes this, he passed away for 30 years ago. Right? So what does it mean in his generation? What about 100 years ago? When was it that we have, who is the we, and when was it that we lost the skill to rebuke? So it's interesting. Eventually I found an answer for it. Do you know that the words in the Torah are the following? Listen to the words, then I'll explain it to you. Hocheyach, rebuke, you shall rebuke, et amitecha. Now, if you have a basic knowledge of Hebrew, it should bother you, the statement. Hocheyach tochiyach et amitecha. The literal translation would be, rebuke the fellow man. You know what would be the proper way in Hebrew to say, to rebuke your fellow man? If I tell you, speak to your fellow man, how would you say? What? What? How? There is something missing. There is a letter missing in what you're saying. Tagid et hachaver shelcha? Is that how you say it in modern Hebrew? Le. Two. That's how you say it in Hebrew. Daber el paroi or le paroi. You don't say daber et paroi. Yeah? In Hebrew, when you say, when you command a communication between you and another fellow man, you would say, speak to the other person. Yeah? So if so, what should be the proper word for hocheach tochiach? Le'amitecha. Do you hear what this commentary asks? It should be, okay, you have to have a basic knowledge for Hebrew to understand this idea. Instead of saying hocheach tochiach et amitecha, it should be hocheach tochiach le'amitecha. Why does it say et amitecha? Okay. What? No. You know what it says? No, again, it's you have to have a basic knowledge of Hebrew. So let me tell you certain principles. You know what the word et means? The, right? Et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. The, that's how you would usually translate it.
Et has no meaning. It's just a word used.
It's hard to translate.
Right. But what about if I read to you the first verse in the book of Exodus? Listen to this verse, first verse in the book of Exodus. We don't have a chumash here, so I'll tell it to you by heart. Eile shmod b'nei Israel. The following are the names of the Jewish people, of the sons of Israel. Habayim mitraima. The ones who came to Egypt, coming to Egypt. Eight Yaakov.
With Jacob
is exactly right. Et, in that case, means with. You hear? As a matter of fact, the rabbis see every et written in the Torah as a hint to something else which is included. As a matter of fact, the Talmud even asks, what do you mean you have to be in awe ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha? With God. Who else with God? Or you have to have respect et Hashem. Who else with God? So you see that in the Talmud, the word et implies someone else who is included, which means that et implies an inclusion.
Why wouldn't they say
im? Oh, very good. So you say, if so, et has the same meaning as im. The fact is that we have two words. There are two ways I can say, I'm walking with you. Ani holeich, with you, how do you say? Imcha,
or
itcha. The cha at the end means with you. The et, itcha, is the et. Imcha is the im. Do you follow what I'm saying? In other words, the fact that there are two words for walking with you, that in itself implies that et and im have similar meanings. Itcha, ani oleich itcha, ani oleich imcha. But your question is valid. We know that there are no synonyms in Hebrew. What is the difference between ani oleich itcha and ani oleich imcha?
Physically.
All right. All right. The point is like this. So the commentaries say the following. The commentaries say, and it's interesting, it becomes 100% clear when we see God speaking to Bilam. Remember Bilam? And Bilam is told, Al teilech itam. Right? And then it says, and Bilam went imam. Here, God says, don't go itam, and he went imam. So the commentaries say, because the difference is the following. If I, for instance, I meet you on the bus, so I'm riding with you, the proper Hebrew word would be imcha, because you are riding and I'm riding, and we have nothing to do with each other. We happen to be riding together. Right? I'm not following you, you are not following me. So the proper word would be imcha, im. But if I'm leading the way and I'm taking you on the bus and you are following me, then you would have to say, Ani nosea itecha. Because I'm following you. There is an interconnection. We are not equal. One is following the other. Do you hear the difference? So the difference between im and et is the same as imcha and itcha. So if it says in the Torah that Bnei Israel, again, the first verse in the book of Exodus, Ve'ele shmos bnei Israel. The following are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Et Yaakov. What does it imply? That when they came, they were attached to Jacob. They recognized Jacob as the leader. They didn't come on their own. They felt that they have to follow Jacob. Jacob was still the leader. You hear clearly? So that means that it implies an attachment. Right? Now, if it says in the Torah, Hocheach tochiach et amitecha, what could it possibly mean? So this great rabbi, right, Hasidic rabbi, Sefat Emet, he says, you know what it means? I'll tell you what it means. It means that in order to rebuke someone, you have to feel with him. What does it mean to feel with him? He says, for instance, what about if the man stole, right? And you get angry, stop stealing, you are destroying society, you are bothering people, right? I'm not with him, I'm against him. So if I'm against him, I have no right to rebuke him because it will never work. You hear this incredible concept? But what about if I see you stealing and it bothers me, crosses my mind, boy, do I feel badly for you. You must have had a terrible childhood, or you must be suffering a lot. I feel with you. So how can I help you that you should stop stealing? Because obviously it's a symptom of something wrong with you. So I feel with you. Oh, only when you feel with people can you rebuke them. Otherwise you have no right to rebuke. Do you have the incredible insight?
Right?
Exactly. That's the idea. The idea is if you can't put yourself in their shoes, then it's meaningless, or your rebuke, because it's not really rebuke, it's self-defense, right? You're just saving yourself. You don't really care for the other human being, okay? You hear this idea? Now, listen to what connection I found, which is amazing. I found in another book something which is apparently unconnected. It says like this, that you know why the second temple, right, was destroyed? Sinat Chinam, it says, because people hated each other. And then there is another statement, that people lo nahagu kavod, right? Lo nahagu kavod. Wait, there is another statement. She lo ahavu. I'm sorry. There is another statement which says like this. She lo ahavu ze et. Ze, that's the statement. Se lo ahavu ze et ze. So on the surface, what does it mean? They didn't love each other. What does it mean? Of course, if they hated each other, they didn't love each other. So I found in one commentary, you know what it says? Se lo ahavu ze et ze. That they lost the capacity to identify with the other person. Eventually, that led to hatred, because if you lose that capacity, if everybody becomes separated from everybody else, everybody becomes a world apart from everybody else, so automatically, there is no unity. If there is no unity, you hate each other. If there is no unity, the temple will become destroyed, because the temple represents the basic unity of the Jewish people. So this is in the Talmud, as a matter of fact. But the comment of ze et ze, this is in one of the commentaries of the Talmud, that it means ze et ze. They lost the capacity to identify with each other. So now, let's put it all together. What does this authority who says we have lost the capacity of rebuke, what does it, who is the we? Since when? Since the destruction of the second temple, of course, because that's the idea of ze et ze. Do you follow what I'm saying? Which means the moment we lost the capacity of relating ze et ze, which means attaching to each other's problems, identifying, putting ourselves into the other person's shoes, then our rebuke is worthless. You hear this idea? It's an incredible idea. The idea is that rebuke only works if you can break out of the limitations of this that we are suffering from and actually identify with the other person. Then, of course, you have the obligation to rebuke him. But you'll have to break out the nature of the era, because we are living in an era for the last 2,000 years where this is lacking. You can break out of it. Right. You can break out of it. The same way we are living in an era of no prophecy, right? No communication with God, but we can break out of it. We say certain people can break out of the level of the era. So, of course, a person can break out of it. But as a rule, we assume that we lost the capacity for rebuke. Now, that does not mean that we shouldn't try. We should try, but we should not be surprised if it doesn't work. Don't blame the other person for being a rejecter of rebuke, because you are not doing a good job, probably. That's the idea behind it.
How does this idea fit into the Christian psychology idea of decisions? You
Yeah, so, you know, that would be a major, major argument. I know that there is such a trend, you know, that the idea of me first, I am first, right? And I have to become assertive. And assertive means that if somebody else is reading out loud and it bothers me, right, so I have to stop it, right? Or if somebody else is doing something, he has a red jacket and I don't like the color red, I should go over and, you know, tell him something or tear it off, you know, as a last resort. We believe that the exact opposite is the right way. That the idea is that a person has to try to identify with the other person's feelings, try to feel with him, and then try to change him for his sake, not for yours. That's a completely, like, diametrically opposed point of view. And there is no concept of assertiveness in Judaism. There is a concept of doing the right thing. Right? Yeah.
I'm trying to relate this to the Vilna Gaon placing of a Kalim on the conceit. It doesn't seem that it reached the state.
Wait. I mean, that was another point. I mean, that was the result. Don't forget. I mean, I don't want to go into the historical background of it. The historical background, you know, the question is that if you are supposed to feel with the other person, how could the Gaon of Vilna that we just mentioned excommunicate the Hasidic Jews, which is what happened. Now, what? All right, so that's the point. Well, not really, that's not the point. That's not because of their difference. He excommunicated them because at the time there was an enormous fear of the Sabbatean movement. Did you ever hear of the Sabbatean movement? Shabtai Tzvi. There was, at that time, still enormous fear for that breakaway movement which destroyed a large portion of the Jewish people. There was a false Messiah who abused, who used out the fact that the Jews were demoralized at the time. They had been suffering for so long. Remember, the Jews in Europe had 1,000 terrible years, you know, we say the Holocaust. The Holocaust is just like the conclusion. The final step in the 1,000 horrible years of the Jews in Europe. There were horrible 1,000 years. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm no historian, but the historians say that no one was as bad as the Christians to the Jews, even though we are so close, after all, ideologically. The pagans are so much more separated from the Jews. The Jews never suffered from the pagans as much as they suffered from the Christians. Okay, either yes or no, I don't know, but that's a theory. The fact is the Jews suffered a lot, and the Jews were already demoralized. They suffered so much, and this Shabtai Tzvi came, and he declared himself the Messiah. Well, I don't know whether we should blame him or not. Some people say he was like an innocent victim of the whole era. He really believed in it. He went to the sultan, of the head of the Turkish, of the Ottoman Empire, and he tried to convince him to allow the Jews to have their own land in Israel. And some people even say that in the beginning he did convince him. At the end, he had to, in order to save his own skin, he had to convert to Islam. He became a Muslim, right? But Jews who were looking, they were so thirsty for some hope, many of them actually accepted him as the Messiah. And when they found out that he became a Muslim, there were thousands of Jews who just abandoned everything in disgust. They abandoned the whole of Judaism because of that. Even though you can be rational and say, listen, what does one have to do with the other? I mean, you can still be a good Jew and not believe in the Shabtai Tzvi. But for such a Jew who has given up years of his life preparing himself, you know, there were people who sold their businesses, who gave up everything, ready to come to Israel because they were sure the Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah. There were communities that they actually changed their prayers because they didn't say, you know, we hope that Mashiach will come someday. No, I mean, he's already here. That's how strong the belief in the Shabtai Tzvi was. So after that, there was such a fear, and after the Shabtai Tzvi, there was another movement, which was probably even worse than the Shabtai Tzvi in a certain way. The Frankist movement, a certain man Frank, who also was terrible for the Jewish people. So there was such a fear that anyone who comes in with new ideas, with new ways of fulfilling Judaism, is immediately suspected of breaking away from traditional Judaism. So there were, you know, according to many, many people, that was the fear of the Gaon of Vilna, that Hasidism
make deteriorate into another Sabbatean or Frankist movement. So therefore, you have to bring them back into the fold. So it's not, that was for a specific reason. Yeah.
There was a side like concerning the Sabbateans, that they had an influence also on the Christians, that many Christian clergymen actually also believed in Shabbat, that he was the Messiah, and this shook the foundations of their faith as their Redeemer. And when it was proven that Shabbat was a fraud, they vented their anger on the Jews, and they made pogroms against the Jews themselves for weakening their own faith in their own Messiah.
Yeah, makes sense. It definitely makes sense.
The Frankists are concerned, I mean, they were way off.
Right.
They had orgies and everything else in order to come to repentance. Yeah. And they also were from a year. Just like you see them.
Well,
exactly.
So it wasn't for lack of sensitivity or, you know, just the opposite. It was because he was so afraid for the future of the Jewish people. Okay, so let me go on in the text itself. It says like this. The method of how to go about, what are the different steps in the obligation to rebuke? You must make sure that you minimize the other person's resistance. The chances are, if you rebuke him in public, you immediately will arouse his resistance. The best way is to develop methods to break down his resistance. Show him that you, as we are speaking about before, showing that you care for him. And you are not out for yourself, you really care for him. So, and you're doing it in a private place where nobody else sees you. Ubelashon racha, and you have to do it in a soft manner. V'divrei nachat kedei shelo itbayesh, in order not to embarrass him. Ve'ein safek, of course, he says, you have to keep changing the method, ideally, until you are successful, if you think you can be successful. But there is a statement in the Talmud. What about if you are certain that you will not be successful? You're certain. Yeah. You're using your judgment. You say, listen, forget it. I'm not going to be successful. Do you still have the obligation to rebuke him? Not anymore. So, of course, we are talking in a situation where you still hope, or you still see hope for eventual success. Now, then he brings down a statement in the Talmud. What about if you feel that by continuing the rebuke, he will physically attack you? It's possible, such a thing. So the point is, ad haka'ah, many people say it means up to the point that you feel that physically you are in danger. But at that point already, you are not obligated anymore to rebuke him.
But you're doing it to the extent that he's going to use, just before he's about to use physical violence, but then it's not doing it on purpose because he's getting angry at your rebuke.
Exactly. I mean, that was, at that point, you know you're not being successful, so stop. It's not that you have to stop because your body's in danger.
Yeah.
Right? That's not the point. It's not that that exempts you. It's that at that point you know you're not going to be successful anymore. Right? That's the idea behind it. Right? That is a sign that the man is getting angry and therefore it's counterproductive, so just stop it right there. And he recalls what I told you before, Keshem Shem Mitzvah Lomar Davar HaNishma. It's a mitzvah to rebuke someone if you sense that he's going to listen. Kach mitzvah lishtok, so it's a mitzvah to keep silent. Bemakom shen adavar nishma. What about if you sense that it won't work? So you say, well, why not try? No, then it's a mitzvah to keep silent, because by telling him, sometimes it's counterproductive. Now, you asked me before, what about parents? What about parents? So, of course, there are no cut and dry rules, because it all depends on your relationship and what their position is, how they feel about it, right? Let's say you became religious, right? And they didn't become religious. So many people, they come back home and they make a revolution at home. That is not necessarily the right way at all, right? The right way would be first to sense their reaction to your actions, first of all. sometimes you see parents who say right away, listen, I have respect for you, you know, I don't necessarily agree with what you say, but I'll go along with you. You want me to eat, to bring kosher food into the house? Sure, I'll go along with it just in order to satisfy you. Fine. If you have parents that go along with everything you do, that's fine. But what about if, like by many, many parents, they see it as a threat? They see it as a terrible threat to what they stand for, right? They are supposed to educate you. They are supposed to have given over their values, and all of a sudden you come with a completely different set of values. So it's a terrible shock to them, and you have to understand it. So in such a situation, you have to minimize the rebuke, right? Because if you sense that everything that you are going to do is going to antagonize them even more, the obligation is to limit the antagonism. So whatever you have to do for yourself, which means that what about if you feel that in order not to antagonize them, you have to share with them eating bacon? Right? That you don't have to do, that you don't have the obligation, which means you don't have to sacrifice your own soul in order to satisfy your parents, because after all, you have a first and foremost your obligation towards your soul. But everything which is extra, like for instance, if it bothers them terribly, for instance, that you don't eat together with them, right? And you know, I remember someone once asked a rabbi that the parents were willing to make kosher, the house kosher, but you know, there are halachic problems. How do you take plates, you know, plates made out of china, right? How do you make it kosher? It's a tremendous problem. So because there are many people say that you can't make it kosher, so you have to take and throw it out or sell it, right? But for many parents, a tremendous sacrifice. So there is a rabbi who says that we can rely on an opinion which says that even china, even though it's a minority opinion, we can rely on the minority opinion just in order to not to antagonize the parents. It's an incredible thing. Even though the majority opinion is that China you can't make kosher, but since there are some who say that China you could make kosher, right? So with certain preconditions, they say, okay, you can make kosher the China just in order that your relationship with your parents should remain good, right? So that is an actual opinion by a very important rabbi, a contemporary rabbi here in Jerusalem.
Did you say make the plates kosher and bring them
to the thing? No, I mean make it kosher just because since they were used for non-kosher food, right, just to make it kosher. Right. Taking it to the mikveh, that's a separate problem. That's a much lesser complication, right? The big problem is a metal silver, like silverware. That's a bigger problem. But the china, there are many people say you don't even need to take it to the mikveh. So you don't even have that problem at all.
For the metalware, the parents might not be willing to bring it to the...
Well, that is already less of a problem because you can do it yourself. You know, you take it home, you take it from home, take it to the mikveh, bring it back, dry it, and that's it. And you have that's a lesser problem. The problem is, what do the parents do when they, you know, if they have to throw out the china? And that's right. So this is what I mean by... You don't have to give up, you don't have to sacrifice your own soul, the purity of your own soul, but anything which is extra, anything which is just beyond the minimum, if that is going to antagonize them, there are many authorities who say, like, forget it. Yeah.
Would that china be considered kosher, or would it be considered as like a peace offering to keep
the peace band? The idea is in order to keep the peace, of course, that's the idea.
Well,
what do you mean?
Place
you mean is that, well, of course, the point is like this. It's an argument. Since there is a minority opinion which says that, I don't want to go into the details, after it hasn't been used for 24 hours and then you make it kosher, so even though it's china, it's still permitted. And there are many other complications that, again, I don't want to go into it. Something that wasn't used on the fire itself, then it's a lesser degree of problem. So therefore, because of all these reasons, you're allowed to do it. And it's the food that you are eating is considered kosher, right? But usually you would take the stricter opinion. But because of the circumstances, you're allowed to take this opinion. Okay, we'll stop here. Whoever wants to say.